Thank you guys for being here. My name is Yair Reamer. I'm really excited about the conversation today. I'm joined with me on stage, Sameer Kaji, the co-founder and CEO at Allocate, and someone who's been in the venture industry and has worked with 700 VC and PE firms in his 20-25-year career, including backing about 67 in the Allocate platform in the last few years. And to his left, your right, David Frankel, who is the co-founder and managing partner at Founder Collective, and one of the top-ranked seed stage investor in 2022 and 2023 on the Midas list. So really excited to have David and Sameer with us this morning for this session. I think I want to jump right in and give you guys a quick background on what we're going to cover in the next 22 minutes or so. I'll be polite and I won't mention their ages, but both of these guys have seen the dot-com bubble. They've been around the 99-2000 days in the industry. They've seen the GFC crisis in 07 and 08. They've seen these cycles, these platform shifts, and how they go up and down. And so we're going to spend the next 20 minutes or so talking about these cycles and really whether or not we learn our lessons from these moments. Do we learn our lessons time over time? So David, I want to start with you. I think Founder Collective was founded in 2009, and at that time, there were about 1,000 or even less venture firms in the U.S. Today, if you fast forward 15 years, there are about 4,000 venture firms in the U.S. Do these 4,000 firms have a right to exist? How do you make sense of that number and that growth in the asset class?
Yeah, tremendous growth, and it feels like so much of the action is at the seed stage. Look, I think there's been so much exuberance about various themes and so many different entrants. When we started off, you know, a lot of VCs were ex-bankers, ex-PE, and if you entrepreneurs who've done well have gone into starting firms. The other thing is, in a much lower interest rate environment, there was a lot of search for alpha. So there's no question. I think before my time, it felt like VC was afternoon tea. And now it's like you feel like you're a barista, you know, at rush hour all the time. But there are a lot of firms and there's a lot of competition. And the continuum of seed is extensive. So from pre-seed to really Series A, that feels like all seed with multi-level firms participating as well. There is tremendous competition. Do they have a right to exist? I think that with the interest rate change, that could change things, and there's maybe less money searching for alpha where there are good opportunities in the market. I also think there is really chasing themes, and AI is the new theme. And if you look back to 2009, the hot company was Groupon, and we were just starting to talk about the sharing economy. And you know, very luckily, thanks to my partner, we were lucky to be in Airbnb and Uber, but the very best investment at that moment was probably Bitcoin. So there's something about chasing themes as well that has given rise to a lot of firms.
Yeah, Sameer, from your perspective, same explosion in growth, you've seen it firsthand. How do you, and there's so many LPs in the room as well, make sense of these 4,000 firms? It's like I'm at a diner and the menu has 500 different salads. I want three to pick from. How do you make sense of these 4,000?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And, you know, it went from like this 700 or 800 firms to 4,000. A lot of it is the fat tail of seed. So if you think about 2010 to 2021, about 2,700 new firms, and it does appear like it's the Cheesecake Factory, right? So many different, you don't know how to pick. Our view is kind of the following. So I think number one is venture is no longer this monolithic industry. There was a time where every venture firm, and you know, I'm dating myself a little bit, and thank you for not saying my age, but back in the early 2000s, you know, most VC firms did the same thing. It was like four or five partners. They were investing across different sectors, and they were generalists. Now, there's so many different flavors. It's like the Baskin-Robbins. We've put it in three buckets. So the three buckets that we look at are: there's the big brands, you know, typically raising funds that are over $1 billion. There are seed stage, which is kind of the fat tail with 2,700. Those typically are sub $150 million funds. And then there's the early stage mid-cap funds. It's kind of like private equity in some ways, right? We've seen the fragmentation. we believe that in seed, you have to be specialized to a certain degree. And we'll talk a little bit more about what we look at. I don't think you can be a mid-cap firm without either an incredible brand or a specialization. And then the brands, of course, tend to be multi-product now. Each one of these different risk returns, you can't put a $10 million seed fund in the same risk return bucket as a $20 billion inside fund. But a lot of people still think of venture as a monolith. So we really break it down into those buckets and then try to find where we can get alpha in each one of those areas.
Makes sense. Tell me a little bit about alpha, David, from the VC side, from the GP investor side. I'd like for you guys to both answer how you think about competition. Has the world gotten more competitive in the last 10, 20 plus years in the asset class? What's changed? What stayed the same? But maybe, David, for you specifically, I've heard you speak a lot at Founder Collective in the past about sort of investing in the who over the what. And has competition for deals increased now that there are sector-specific specialists focused in these categories or in these geos more than they maybe were 15 years ago at the start of your firm? Have you seen that when you're fighting for a deal, to win a deal?
There is tons of competition, and it's exceptionally good for entrepreneurs. Look, I think you have to be distinctive. You have to have a product. And not only for your LPs, you have to have a product for the entrepreneur. You have to be very clear. At the time that we got started, there was something like 500 Series A funds. And to stand out, we decided to do institutional seed. It had been done on the West Coast. There was less of it on the East Coast. And so we constrained ourselves to literally A stage and have always stuck by that in the thought that creates tremendous alignment between us and the entrepreneur, that we dilute alongside the entrepreneur. I think that for an entrepreneur looking for that, we're distinctive, but we lose deals all the time. A great example is, you know, last week there was AI in the defense contracting space, a company we thought 5 on a 25 post was a very fair deal for what they'd accomplished. And they were talking to a later stage firm that came in 10 on a 37 post with a 20% share option plan. We would look at that and say they're over diluting. But frankly, in this environment, the entrepreneur was scared of raising capital further on. So we'll lose there, but our mantra is capital efficiency, so we expect to lose. There's a self-selection, I think, based on how distinctive your branding, and not just your branding, your purpose and how you follow through is. So, I mean, a great example is in 2016, and this goes to the who rather than the what, we funded a company called Shield AI, and the name meant nothing to me. It is drones in the, so it's autonomous drones without Wi-Fi, without any cell phone signal, and there literally is an artificial intelligence component in terms of these drones coordinating each other. But I'd met Brandon and Ryan Tseng. Brandon was like the business brains. Ryan was a Navy SEAL. And fell in love. So if there are entrepreneurs that want to do things very capital efficiently, I think they self-select to us. If you want a lot of capital, then FC and our ilk is less. But frankly, you can't do you can't do satellites the capital efficiently. So there is a self-selection going on for sure.
That's fair. So they're finding you because you've built the brand, which is so critical from a capital efficiency perspective. Sameer, how do you look at managers who stay in their lane and stay between their guardrails? And then also, David, for you as a follow-up, when do you make those exceptions to the rule? Because clearly there must be times where you're like, okay, 5 on 25, that fits my rubric. Maybe I'm pragmatic or am I dogmatic, but at what point do you break that? And Sameer, from your perspective, do you look for that consistency in managers? Do you have sort of a rubric around looking at these firms and what differentiates them from others?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things there to unpack. So number one, in terms of, you know, do you be rigid, do you be dogmatic, or do you make exceptions? I think the best VCs always make exceptions. They need to figure out what is that decision-making framework to make an exception. You can't, if you only make exceptions, then your entire fund is an exception, right? Yeah. You don't want that. In terms of what we look at and what differentiate, I don't think of things in the term differentiation. I think more about edge. Sure. Differentiation for the sake of differentiation actually doesn't do anything. I was in Vegas a few years ago. This reminds me of this story, and this is kind of, it's really, really stuck with me. And we were at a table, and there was a guy there that, you know, was a pretty prolific card player, and he played poker, he played blackjack. And, you know, I was just picking his brain and just saying, hey, you know, I like blackjack. I don't really know what I'm doing, but, you know, tell me a little bit how you play. And he said, number one, the house has an edge, right? So the house has an edge. Now, what people might be surprised about is the house edge is typically less than 1%, depending on what table you sit at, how many decks, how many, you know, what the payout is on certain things. And he's like, you need to find a table that actually gives you the best odds of winning. And if you think about people that play blackjacks, there are certain people that are learning blackjack. Well, the house odds go up because they don't know when to hit. They don't know when to, you know, stay, things like that. And you can go down to a negative 5%, you know, sort of like house, you know, having the edge over you. But if you think about counting cards, right? So there's this, you know, concept of counting cards, which is basically the number of decks, looking at what you do plus minuses. And what he told me was, like, if you do that, you create basically an edge over the house that could be anywhere from 1% to 5%. So it starts off at, like, 1%. And then as you have the positive count, he's all, you double down, you triple down, you figure out how to press your advantage, and it can be up to 5%. And so what we look for managers, you know, at the end of the day is, what is your version of counting cards, right? At the end, you know, you're looking at sourcing, picking, winning. And so what usually that means is you're looking at the intersection between GP and business model fit. Are you sitting at the right table? Are you playing to your favor? Are you doing things that really align with what you're good at? And from there, when you have an advantage, are you pressing? Similar to what, you know, David and team have done, they've built this incredible brand that has now been 14 years and founders know them. So they have the ability to press their advantage, but they've stayed in their lane. I think the last one was what, some 100 million still.
Yeah.
And that's your version of counting cards, I guess, from that perspective. In terms of the breaking the rules and the exception, as Samir made, you can't have a fund filled with exceptions. But talk to us about an exception or two. Talk to us about how challenging that is. I think that's something that everyone wrestles with from a valuation and a pricing perspective.
Look, we still think of the world in kind of the cardinal points of people, opportunity, context, deal, and very much in that order. So deal, lost. My partner's joke with me is saying, you know, if you meet someone that can do it on the smell of an oil rag, like, you're immediately in love. I like capital efficient entrepreneurs. It comes from really, I guess, where Micah, Eric, myself, where we started in terms of building our businesses. But you've got to grok with the individual first and foremost. Our view is, if we can make that happen, we will get to a deal. The deal. You know, we've got to remind ourselves, like, every one of us in this room, we're so lucky to be here. We're investing and we're starting companies in the most efficient, frictionless ecosystem in the world. So a lot of that is decided by the market. What is the, literally, what's the going price in the market? The fact is, deal and terms still matter a lot. Mm-hmm. And if I think of, we were lucky enough to get involved with the founders at PillPack in 2013. That was roughly $1 billion exit to Amazon, and that returned Fund 2. If we had gotten involved in 2021, just the market conditions in terms of the pricing of that would have been different, and certainly I don't think we would have returned the fund. So does it matter in terms of entry price? It does matter. Do we break the rules? We do. We break the rules less on leading, and sometimes when there's participation, we will break the rules. Yeah. So Suno, which is a company that we invested in, Mikey Shulman, the ex-Kensho team, just superstars. Nobody in the world, I think, can do voice and audio like this team. Do we break the rules for them? Because they say, look, we don't even need to take money. We don't want any dilution. And I want to get involved with them. But the market dictates to some degree, you know, you're in or you're out there.
Makes sense. You spoke about PillPack and you spoke about how that would be in 2021, a different environment. So Samir, talk to us about 2021 a little bit and 2022. I think there were something like 1,200 unicorns minted in those 2 years. Euphoria in the market. Obviously, we all agree, everyone in this room agrees that tech is the biggest driver of GDP growth in the next decade, and the Magnificent Seven publicly traded companies are all VC-backed. And so we're believers, but what happens to those 1,200 unicorns? What happens when the valuations became what they were in 2021 versus when David finds PillPack in 2013? What's the fallout that you see in the funds in those unicorns in the next few years?
It's a complicated question and a complicated answer. So let's just look at 2021, and your partner, Mark, has talked about what happened. So if you think about the number of unicorns, when Aileen Lee first wrote about it, I think it was 2013, there was like four unicorns. And the whole definition for her was, you know, companies that reach $1 billion in valuation within 10 years. In 2021 alone, about 700. Of those 700, I think Mark mentioned this, that 60% of those rounds that minted those companies in unicorns were basically led by four investors, SoftBank and Tiger being two of them. So those unicorns are really more of a function of the capital market versus the actual fundamentals of the company. In fact, you know, enterprise SaaS multiples, I think in 2021, were about 25x. So as a private market investor doing Series B, C, D, and E, you could pay anywhere between 25 and 75x an arbitrage between the private and public markets. Obviously, everything changed at the end of 2021. Rates went up so dramatically, so people started to move money out. Public markets obviously shifted. And, you know, there's a lot of companies right now that raised so much capital in 2021 that the pain that we thought we would see in the first 18 months has just been extended. So a lot of those companies, I'd say about 10% of those companies, of those, let's say 1,200, will exit at an amount over the next 5 years at least what their last private market is or higher. The vast majority, there's going to be a lot of zombies, or, you know, as Aileen says, papercorns. Covidicorns is another one that we came up with. And it's going to be tough. I mean, these, you know, to be a public company, even at $1 billion valuation, and as a SaaS company, you're probably 150 to 200 million in revenues with decent margins. So a lot of these companies will not, and I don't want to say they fail completely, but they will not return any tangible capital that's meaningful to the investors and certainly the common shareholders. And that's going to take some time to play out. And I think when everyone said cut, burn, cut, burn, cut, burn, what we did is really just kick the can down the road for what likely is going to be an inevitable outcome for a lot of these companies, unfortunately.
Do you see it in the same way, David, or is there anything different when you're looking at your portfolio or your peers?
I mean, I think Samir's nailed it. It's just a totally different fundraising environment. The hybrids have disappeared. There was a moment where John at Tiger did 220 on 100 posts in our portfolio in 1 week, and it was the third that he did in that month. That's disappeared. The hybrids are kind of trying to figure out what they can do with the rest of that portfolio. There are, even before you get to the $1 billion companies, the level that you've got to get to get a good Series A or Series B done. So I think of seed as this continuum where seed is now very, very noisy, and it's everything from pre-seed to Series A, and there's some, but you want to get to Series B. So there's tons of extensions happening. And then there are, we've seen situations where a Series A investor alongside us has led kind of the Series B. They've called it a Series A extension. Some of our LPs have participated, and that is because it's not ready for the Series B or the Series C. So it's before you even get to the unicorns. And if you ask me what I spent most of my time doing the last 6 months of 2023, it was shoring up those kind of companies where, in a lot of cases, the theme or the vertical was out of favor. So DTC, you know, very similar to the company Yummers that just spoke, DTC company in the cat food space, $15 million ARR at the beginning of 23, close to $40 million by September, easily on track to $50 million if you don't literally take down the CAC a lot and cap off your spend, and nobody around. It just depends on the theme. Now, AI, tremendous amount of exuberance. There's AI on everything. Sure. And I think of some of the companies on the boards that I'm on and how much work we're doing to think about how do we keep our customers and add in an AI angle. And it's not easy to raise capital. So I'd say the whole capital raising environment has changed. And, you know, the ex-unicorns, they're unicorns, but they're not, you know, they're walking as unicorns right now. But
unicorpses.
Yeah. Unicorpses. They're no exception. Yeah. By the way, it comes down to going back to the capital efficiency. We talk about, because we've had thrown back at us, you know, Uber, Coupang, they raise billions of dollars. What do you mean by capital efficiency? And capital efficiency before product market fit, right? That's kind of the disclaimer. And then once you've got product market fit, go crazy. Sure. But a lot of these companies did not have real product market fit.
There
so you see churn. Yeah.
Absolutely. Maybe quickly in our last few minutes, you guys have both mentioned the importance of teams. Edge with card counters. You've mentioned some entrepreneurs from Shield AI or from PillPack or even Micah and Eric or Hannah and John or others in the room that you guys work with. For the audience, I think, David, you mentioned it earlier, 20 years ago, the industry was perhaps many ex-investment bankers, financial background. Now we have a lot of former operators or product-led kind of solo and emerging managers. Talk to me about talent. And what you guys see in terms of venture teams. What have you both learned about what's the best way to structure a venture team? You guys are very lean. Samir, you've seen hundreds and hundreds of funds. And how to have the composition in venture teams.
Yeah, I mean, so a few things there. Number one, I don't think there's like one size fits all. I think there's a number of different ways. In fact, some of the best VCs of all times came from places like journalism, Mike Moritz, for example. Yeah. Bill Gurley obviously had a very different background before he started. It's more about creating a certain ethos and hiring people that actually fit that culture. Like, you know, Founder Collective very much, you know, focused on this ethos of how do you become that founder's first call. Things have changed, of course. More operators turned, you know, VCs. We've obviously seen a lot of people that have spun out of big firms, starting their own shops. I don't know that there's a single formula, but we have three non-negotiables that we look at in traits of VCs and how they build their teams. Number one is this insane level of curiosity where they know they don't know everything, and ultimately every single day is a learning opportunity. And that is true for even, you know, the top firms. I mean, Doug Leone said on a podcast recently, which I really liked, he said, "We haven't done anything tomorrow, so I need to learn." Second is this almost chip on your shoulder that creates like this grit and hustle of you'll do anything not to lose. And then the third thing that we look at is people that fundamentally will question everything. And you know, in VC, sometimes you did a deal back in 2007, it didn't work. So you're like, no way this can work now. But Webvan, for example, was just too early. Instacart obviously worked. So we look more from traits versus like, it has to be a certain formula of people.
Perfect. Well, that's our time, guys. But thanks. I'm fitting ending on talent. Two talented guys. Please give it up for David and Samir. Thank you very much for
Thank you.
Their conversation.
Great.
Thank you.
Yeah.